There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. This episode is brought to you by Noom. Forget one-size-fits-all diets. With Noom, you get a personalized weight loss plan that's tailored to your lifestyle. No food is off limits. Enjoy your favorites while discovering healthier habits. Noom's users love the flexible approach, blending psychology and biology to help you lose weight in a way that's sustainable for you. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's N-O-O-M. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Welcome to the ID10T podcast number 997. If you're going to be in Nashville or Salt Lake City, Nashville at the end of May, Salt Lake City the next weekend in June, I'll be doing the stand-ups. And I'm actually playing music on stage now, which is a strange... I mean, I always did it with Mike Furman, but he's a really good musician and great musical performer and comedian. And so I've been kind of learning how to play guitar. So come on out for that! I will be at Zany's in Nashville and then at Wise Guys in Salt Lake City. But the show's been really fun, so please come out. Get tickets before they're gone. Links are at id10t.com. And now it's time for the corkboard. This is the ID10T community corkboard. You being a part of the ID10T community, I assume, if you're listening to this. If you're new, welcome. And if you're not, thank you. This comes from Charlie and Michael, who write, "We're Charlie and Michael, the hosts of Eat Your Veggies, a nutrient-dense podcast serving the best in art and pop culture. We've read, watched, and played so much in our 10 years together, as well as listened to so many podcasts, of which yours is a fave." Thank you. "Through casual but thoughtful conversations, we hope to elevate what some consider lowbrow media and make the highbrow more accessible. We're coming up on episode 5, which is a comedy roundup, including Broad City, the other two, and Veep. As a budding podcast, we could use the boost as we start to create a community where people proudly share the art they're passionate and nerdy about." Sound familiar? Very good job, Charlie and Michael. So there you go. Hopefully, this boost provides a nice kick up into the podcast stratosphere. And well done and congratulations on launching the show. Steven writes, "My good friend Michael Guest and his business partner Chris Abel have been operating New Wave Pro Wrestling since 2014. On Saturday, May 4th, they're hosting the third annual Bash for Babies at the Putnam County Fairgrounds, located at 191 US 231 in Greencastle, Indiana. This year's special guest is WWE Hall of Famer Badass Billy Gunn. The event starts at 7 p.m. Admission is $15. You can find tickets and more info by Googling 3rd Annual Bash for Babies." You get a lot of baby raves if you go up there. Just the babies with the Dr. Seuss hats and the rave whistles and the big glasses. That's really adorable. That should be a thing. I'm sure it must be a thing. This episode, speaking of adorable, is Martin Cove. Martin plays John Kreese, first in Karate Kid, then in Karate Kid 2, then in Karate Kid 3, and then he's done a shit ton of other television and film. He was in Rambo, he was in Cagney and Lacey, and he's a great guy. You know, the villains, so many of the villains, on-screen villains, turn out to be the best people, and Marty is no exception. Yes, I get to call him Marty now. I can't imagine what I would have told tiny me watching Karate Kid in the theater with my dad. Like, someday I'm going to be pals with that guy and I'm going to call him Marty. I don't even think I would have known how to process that. Also, what's a podcast would be my question at 11 or however old I was. So Cobra Kai, as you may know, because a ton of people are watching it, is in season 2 now. It is available now. And if you haven't seen it, especially if you were a fan of Karate Kid, you absolutely have to. It's such a great take on the continuation of the storyline. And season 1 was great. It's like 10 episodes. Season 2 has launched, and Marty's in season 2. And I could not be happier about it. So, this is the ID10T podcast number 997 with Martin Cove.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
Thank you, Jesse boy.
We'll just
integrate a leg in this. This looks like straight espresso.
You don't say sweep the leg? Come on. You've been hearing that your whole life. Yeah. Thank you. I mean, come on. That's a good
sweep
look.
Sweep the sword, you know. Sweep the sword.
Somewhere there's a sword in here. So actually, I think there is.
There's got to be. This is not a house without a sword. Come on, man.
I'll tell you what we don't have that's disappointing is a suit of armor. Like, we need a suit of armor.
Oh, you do. God.
Yeah.
It's the best thing to have in a house because you never know. Like, those are the creepiest things. You never know if someone inside of it.
Yeah. You know, it'd be the perfect place to hide a body. No one would ever think to look inside.
You know, that's a great idea. That actually should be noted.
Slit in the wall with eyes, you know, so when people walk by, goes like,
you gotta have the painting.
Oh yeah, you gotta have the eyes like this.
Yeah,
and you cut big holes so everybody makes sure you see them as they walk by your guests. You don't tell them. And the eyes on the armor goes. It just motion detection.
Yeah,
motion detection. It just goes.
Just follows them.
It just follows them.
We have the technology have to do that now.
Oh, we do. We have masks. We can do that with.
Oh yeah.
We have big masks. I got in Cabo San Lucas. Giant masks that I put on the wall, and everybody gets scared, and they all say they have mirrors in the eyes, and they're all to ward off the evil spirits.
Sure.
And they do, and people get uncomfortable seeing them in my house. Now we put eyes in them.
Now they'll have a purpose.
Fuck
yeah, fuck it. Seriously. No. They go, oh, no, these are really haunted.
Right. Yeah, they are haunted. Yeah, these just be careful. Don't get too close.
Halloween is our favorite time of year. We go insane for Halloween.
So do we.
My favorite friggin', we go nuts.
Jesse and I did Hercules.
Yep.
So when I did Hercules out, I must have done Hercules 20 years ago in Auckland. So part of my deal was to have the Roman chess piece, the tunic, the cape. I said, I want it all. And when I'm done, you can send it back to me. And so they never sent it to me. So the 2 days before Halloween in 1996, the day after I did the show, I called them up. And this was the same woman who won the wardrobe for the costume award for Lord of the Rings.
Oh, wow.
Same lady. And she says, they haven't sent you your account yet. I said, no, and I wanted to wear it in 2 days. It's Halloween. I'm in L.A. and I'm calling her in Auckland. FedExed my entire tunic, cape, helmet, sword, everything. FedExed it all to me. And Saturday morning it arrived for Saturday night.
Oh, that's fantastic.
You know,
it delights me to no end that you appreciate that stuff. Because that's, you know, it's like some people just sort of look at acting as like, oh, it's a job. And you go in, you say your lines, you go home. But it's always nice to know that people that you're fans of are fans that like to play and like to keep the stuff.
When I was in the contract to a company called Transworld Entertainment,
mm-hmm.
and they were late to a dinner party that my wife was throwing in that house I told you about in Laurel Canyon, and so I was really upset that they were late, and I said, I'm going to, you know, punish these guys because I'm very big in the Old West. So they came late for the dinner. We had the dinner, and I opened up my Advent, my 1984 Advent, those screen, big screens, the first ones that you pull out,
yeah.
And three guns. And I put the last scene of Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, the triangle gunfight on.
Mm-hmm.
I dressed these two straight conservative business executives. I dressed them in dusters and six guns. And I said, we're going to walk around the living room to the final soundtrack that Ennio Morricone did, great trumpets and all that, the final gunfight with Lee Van Cleef, Eli Wallach, and Clint Eastwood of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And when they stop, the music stops, guys, and I dressed them up, and I made them walk around with me. We go for our guns.
So you were playing musical guns, basically.
Yeah, playing musical guns because it was 6 minutes. And you know, the cuts in that scene were like eyes, guns, back of hips, you know. They were great cuts, and you never knew when you're going to have to draw.
And they went along with it.
Yeah, they had to go. Like, they were so embarrassed about being late to this dinner that I said, you know, you guys are not getting dessert until you do this.
You know, that is an acceptable shaming. That is an acceptable type of shaming. No one gets hurt, but it teaches them a lesson.
Yeah.
And I bet they were never late again after
never
that.
Never late again. But I thought it was really rude. I mean, you know, it was. I didn't have a bunch of people. It was just they, because they would be discussing what I was on. I was doing Cagney and Lacey at the time.
Yeah.
And it was in the 80s, and I was willing to do to make a deal. And we were going to discuss the scripts and directors and all. And they came like an hour late. And I just said, no, they've got to be punished.
They have to. So what do they say when they're leaving at the end of the night?
They had a great time.
Oh, good.
Because no one does that to these guys.
Yeah.
No one dresses up. Can you imagine dressing up Jeffrey Katzenberg? Or can you you know, can you imagine?
Put it on, Jeff.
You know, you can't do it. But these were, you know, they really wanted me. I was hot from Karate Kid 1 and 2, and I was doing Cagney and Lacey, and they wanted me to be in business with them. You know, so we never made the movies. I got paid for both these two pictures because we could never agree on a script of the director. But that was 2 years later.
Oh, my God.
But this was the time when, you know, we thought we could all agree on something.
Isn't that funny that it's just the way that the business works, that there are many things that just never happen? Like, how many things do you think you were involved in that you're like, oh, this is going to be great, and then it just doesn't materialize?
80%.
Yeah.
At least 80%. And they're still going on. They still go on. And you never know what to say, because there are so many projects that are really surprises, like Karate Kid.
Yeah.
And have we been on the whole time?
Yeah.
That's what I figured.
Yeah.
So there have been so many interesting projects that you don't know if – I didn't know. We didn't know in this movie. I mean, I read the script. It was going to be another heavy I was going to play.
Mm-hmm.
And it was well written. But I never thought it would have the iconic value that it did. And nobody did. We didn't even think the title – was anything sounding anything more than a Bruce Lee movie,
mm-hmm.
you know? And eventually, you know, when I became friends with Robert Kamen, and we discussed it a great deal, and until the edited version that he watched with John Avildsen, they didn't really know they had a hit until John put it all together. Because John started off as an editor back in the mid-70s when he did Joe and all that.
Mm-hmm.
He was out of the early Cannon Productions, a company in New York, he did Joe for, and he was basically an editor before that. So, I mean, I went to him the day after I did my scenes in the dojo where I have the crazy stuff where I say, you know, I like that. You're a pushy little bastard, you know, and I wanted that scene for my reel. So 2 days later, I went to John. He had it edited already. I mean, he had it set up in his house, editing the movie daily as we went along. And finally, when he showed Robert, you know, his rough cut, they realized this was huge.
And oh, my God.
Jerry Weintraub always thought it was huge, but it's Robert and John that had the great vision. And before them, Frank Price, who hired Robert Mark Kamen Frank Price was Robert's protege, was Robert's mentor, and believed in him and said, here's this article about a bullied kid, go write a screenplay.
Man.
35 years later, we're doing a series with the same kind of guys. There's, you know, Josh Heald and Hayden and John are brilliant fans of the genre, of this movie, and they write us great stuff.
It is great, and I was telling your friend Rick, publicist?
Yes.
Yeah. I was telling him that, and then when Billy and Ralph were on the podcast like a year ago, with so many things getting remade and rebooted, it would have been really easy for this to just be a lazy remake. Not, you know, like where they didn't really focus on whether or not it was good. Like, yeah, it'll just sort of keep, but it's great. And I love this like complicated emotional dynamic. There's really adult shit going on with guys who cannot let it go. And I love that Daniel LaRusso, the lazy version of that is like he lives happily ever after. But he's kind of a dick, and he's haunted by stuff that happened. Like, they just cannot get past their teenage years. And I think that's such a great way to present this, because that's what would happen. That's exactly what would happen.
Well, you know, this is their Star Wars. This is, I mean, you know, I get this nickname, the Darth Vader of the karate world, you know? And this is their, you know, they paid attention to it for 16 years. And when I met them, the only thing that sold me, because I felt like you, we all get scripts. God knows how many movies all of us have done that the producer would say it's going to be just like Karate Kid.
Right.
We're going to make it just like Karate. And your character is going to be like, and the script was never, you know.
Yeah.
And so they were so adept at persuasion and adept at writing and so brilliant with their plans for the characters that Billy and Ralph were sold straight away. And then I met them and they said, we want you to come in on the 10th episode and set up season two where you'll be a regular in season two and three. And I said, why can't I come in on episode 5 and 6? And they said, because you're going to set up the second season. But they were so astute with what they had to say and why. And they knew backstories about my character that I would only give in interviews for magazines, stuff of why John Kreese was like he was and why he, you know, what problems he had in Vietnam and why he came back and no mercy on all his opponents was so important to him. And mercy is for the weak and how those things evolved. They knew them all. They knew all that. They knew, and when I wanted to, at the beginning, once the show had aired, and I said, I have some plans for season two, and they said, and I met with Army Rangers, and we talked about all this, and how Cobra Kai got its name and all that. And they had all this stuff planned already. I met them in a restaurant in Beverly Hills after the first meeting, and I had yellow pad, illegal pad, all my notes that I met with my former friends, my friends who were former Army Rangers. They knew all this stuff. They had it all, why he became a bully, flashbacks of his childhood. I said, gee. I've done 5 TV series, over 100 pictures. I've never worked with anybody that's researched their ass off and then can put it down on paper and then kind of perceive the future by their actions, which the future does happen. And I said this at WonderCon on the weekend. I said, I've never worked for anybody they're 40 years old with more energy than I have and yet can perceive the future of how things are going to go per their literature and development of character. And it does.
Mm-hmm.
Because Hollywood, how many times, what do we have, like maybe 20% of the people are sincere in the entire city?
That's a very generous estimation, too, 20%.
You know?
It could be like 10.
10, okay. 8, yeah, 8,
maybe?
8, 10, yeah.
Yeah, but, yeah. But they've just, you know, the best villains aren't just black and white, like they're evil and these people are good. Everyone's complicated and complex and understanding that, you know, this guy wasn't, you know, Darth Kreese maybe was Anakin Kreese at some point, you know, like maybe he was a good guy that just got some hard knocks, didn't really have the emotional tools to deal with them, then goes and gets fucked up over in Vietnam. And you kind of, you know, it's just like that thing that Miyagi says about like just having bad teachers. He just had, like, life taught him to be that way. And that's kind of why he was that way. What had you thought about, like, I'm sure this might be explored in season two. Do they sort of talk about what happens to him between Karate Kid 2 and the series? For like that moment where he, you know, he puts his hand through the windows of the car and he's all fucked up, and then it's like, oh, he got his comeuppance. Mm-hmm. And then, like, what do you think happens to him in between these two periods?
Well, you know, what happened is no one enrolled after Karate Kid 2.
Yeah.
Which was basically the extent. You know, that scene was written to be the end of Karate Kid 1.
Right.
So, it introduced him directly right after the tournament, and he breaks the trophy and he strangles his son. And his son is, he probably loved it, which comes out a lot in season two. You know, you'll understand that he really loved Johnny Lawrence, mm-hmm. but what he loved more was Cobra Kai.
Right.
So you have to understand that the integrity of Cobra Kai, which I can't give away much, but the integrity of Cobra Kai was somewhat, it was troubled. in season two. And he's got to straighten that out. And that's why he comes back in episode 10, season one. Cobra Kai is back on top. He wants to come and play. But he's got to maintain. It's got to be maintained as Cobra Kai.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting because what he does in, from episode two, he's gone bankrupt. Kids don't come and join his dojo because of the, you know, his actions at the end of the tournament. It goes around town, can't pay his bills. And then he's saved by his friend Terry Silver in Karate Kid 3.
That's right. To get revenge on, yes.
Yeah, to get revenge. And what happened to me was Karate Kid 3 was all my vehicle. There was no Terry Silver. It was all written for me. And Robert did a great job. And I couldn't do it because I got a TV series, Hard Time on Planet Earth, which is at that time Jeff Katzenberg.
That's so funny. Yeah.
So he was head of Disney and I couldn't get out of the show. And my agent said, I'll get you out of that series and, you know, you'll be able to do the movie because the movie's all about you. Couldn't do it.
This is where we track down Jeffrey Katzenberg and make him dress up in Western gear.
Yeah, that's it.
So it should have been. That's so. I didn't know that. That's a great bit, and it makes so much sense.
Oh, I got on the phone with him. I mean, I'm here with Jerry Weintraub, John Avildsen, the head of business affairs, all in a room, and the AD. The AD says we can shoot Marty Cove out on weekends. I don't know how he was going to do that because it was a big part, and John didn't want to do that. And so I said, one last draw, let me call Katzenberg. It was a Disney show for CBS. And I said, let me call Jeff. So I called Jeff, and he was, you know, honest. He says, I love you in those movies, those Karate Kid movies. I hate to get in the way, but I have an air date. You are the only star. It's a piece called Hard Time on Planet Earth, written by the same people that wrote The Predator, Jim and John Thomas. And I was the deal. I was coming right out of Cagney and Lacey, and so I was the guy who's going to, you know, somewhat save the network. So, you know, in short, I couldn't do the movie I wanted to do. So I had to come in on weekends and do it. And I was embarrassed. I was hurt. I felt that I really sort of, you know, I broke a friendship with the producer and the writer and all that. I felt very embarrassed that they thought I might have been deliberate.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't. I was basing it on my agent telling me I could move the series or I could get you out of it. Never happened. So I came in on weekends, did the job. And from then all the way to the big question is, what has happened to John Kreese after Karate Kid 3 to now, 30 years later? I would tell people, because I was vowed secrecy, not to tell anybody that I was coming back on the show on episode 10. So they made 9 episodes, and everybody at conventions, wherever I go, would say, aren't you coming back to the show? Aren't you going to be in that series? And I would have to lie, and I'd have to lie a lot. So I would make up stories that would interest me. Like I was working for the KGB, I was working for the CIA, you know, I was in prison, you know, so because everybody would ask me and, you know, they didn't believe me, anything I said, they figured something else was going on.
Of course.
You know, you were a mercenary and, you know, but I couldn't tell the truth. And ultimately now I could tell the truth, you know, and it's very exciting. I mean, the writing is so great. And Robert loves the writing, and I didn't even know that he was being, those characters were mentored by Robert Mark Kamen, you know, and they're just great guys, and they work so hard. They work, you know, Billy and I are going to work at 6 in the morning, and we're shooting. In the last month, we had 3 crews working because all the shows were overwritten because we could never do all the work in one day because they were great, and nobody mind working late hours, and they were just terrific, but we couldn't get them all done in the scheduled day. So we were doing episode 4 or episode 2 while we're shooting episode 8.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd have 2 other crews doing stuff and splintering the wardrobe and hair, and it was hard because chronologically you're in one place with one episode, and then you move to another emotional chronological place, you know, 3 hours later. From episode 4, and you're shooting episode 8, but these writers, we complained, but what good was it? They were ruthless. they would go home and rewrite for the next day. They would play with the editing. They would come back in the morning and direct, all in the same 24-hour period. And Billy and I would laugh and say, who are we to get uptight? We're just throwing our face in front of the camera. You know, these guys are doing 4-5 different jobs in the same 24-hour period.
Yeah.
So we'd laugh about that. And now the show, and then when we saw the shows, we saw why, because they're all really good.
Yeah. What do you think the show – what do you think this world and this universe between the movies and the show, what do you think they teach people about – overcoming obstacles, overcoming their own personal demons? Like, what do you think is sort of some of the more complex human takeaway from the story, rather than just, hey, don't be a bully?
Well, it isn't about don't be a bully anymore. We've passed that. Because how they wrote my character, and I can't give away too much, there's a lot of texture. There's vulnerability. There's a lot of exciting things go on. But there also is a lot of the old John Kreese that's ever present, you know. And remember, John Kreese was a winner for a long time. And then he went to Vietnam and he wasn't allowed to win, like so many of our soldiers were not allowed to win. And how, you know, many times a little child who seems to be helpless would come up to the platoon and seek chocolate or something in Viet Cong boy. And then all of a sudden, he'd press a little button and blow himself up, like in Afghanistan, and I'd lose 3 or 4 platoon members, you know. And so John Kreese adopted the concept of no mercy, and mercy is for the weak, because you deserve to have happen to you if you show weakness.
Right.
And he had that great chant where he said, if a man confronts you, he is your enemy, an enemy deserves no mercy, you know. And that's just how he thought, because he was indoctrinated with that. Prior to that, I don't believe, other than an occasional bully, which we'll see in season 3, or if this is season 3, we'll see his background. You know, we'll see why he's such a bully. Because I haven't gone back that far. I've only gone back into Vietnam. But they have aspirations of experiencing and revisiting his early childhood.
Oh, wow. Yeah, because he's sort of, you know, he was the oppositional force. So it makes sense to just... You really are sort of like mapping the emotional genealogy of this world. You have to go back and see what he's like, because it sets in motion this whole like Rube Goldberg machine of, you know, emotions and fights and, you know, like and where everything kind of unfolds.
I had a dream last night. I don't know why it came up, but I had a dream last night about an old flame of his, a woman who comes back into his life. And it wasn't an intricate dream, because we didn't get into where she's been or where I knew where I've been. But there's a lot of interesting ideas, you know, if and when we know about season 3, which will be shortly. There's so much to explore. Because to answer your original question, John, there are other levels to this character, just like there are other levels, you were saying, about it isn't about bullying, it isn't black and white. Mm-hmm. All the characters are written gray.
Mm-hmm.
In the days, I'm a big Western advocate, and the days of just black hats and white hats, and the days of the Western, they're over. Your characters have got to be like Clint, you know, jaded, and you know, it started kind of with the good, the bad, and the ugly, pretty much, you know, because he was the white, he was the good, but he wasn't good. He was a bounty hunter, he was a killer, you know, which Clint plays so very well. And Dirty Harry was the most prejudiced, you know, son of a bitch. cop you've ever seen, you know, but that's 1972, and I think, you know,
but the name Dirty is in the title. They tell you he's not a great guy in the title,
but it was the first, so you didn't really know what that meant.
Yeah.
You know, Dirty Harry, you know, you see Naked City, you understand the first of the cop shows, and you know you have all these different names, Magnum PI, but you don't know Dirty Harry. You know, Dirty Harry is 1972, written by my friend John Milius, and you know, Dirty Harry was a cop who really, you know, do you feel lucky, punk?
Yeah.
You know, he's to mess with you. He was very much John Kreese. You know, you just got good or you're bad.
Right.
If you're not on my side, you're bad.
Right.
You know?
And he'll do whatever he needs
to. Yeah, whatever he does.
Yeah, dispose of you.
Exactly. So right now it's 50 years later.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't approach it that way anymore. But you have to approach it in a sophisticated form that they write John Kreese, because John Kreese does think society has gotten soft. The concept of kids getting trophies for participation doesn't work,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I don't analyze it with how I feel, because how I feel, you know, you often think about kids that are not as good as the better athletes. So therefore, even if they try, they should be rewarded for that effort. That's Martin Cove. But I don't really know if giving them the same trophy as you give the boy who is scoring the most goals for the soccer team, I don't know if it equates. I'm not sure. I haven't figured that out yet. But John Kreese doesn't think it's even necessary.
Yeah, but it's also interesting that, you know, so Johnny is basically, he's sensei to this ragtag group of nerds, which is great. I mean, the idea of, like, putting these kids with him rather than just putting duplicates of a young John Lawrence, like that Cobra Kai is basically fundamentally these nerdy kids. And they start to, especially the kid Hawk, he goes nuts. He goes crazy. And but you understand why, because he has bullied himself. And, you know, when people are bullied, one of two things happens. They either become very compassionate or they become very protective and aggressive and angry. And that's what happens to this kid. But you kind of watch it happen. So you go, like, if the series just dropped and you saw this kid with a mohawk, you'd be like, what a dick. But because you see how this cycle of bullying, like, propagates and replicates, you understand, like, yeah, of course that kid's probably going to turn out that way. And then he has these kind of leanings, and then he gets this one teacher that gets in his head, and then that's what happens. Like, that's the formula. So there's such an interesting, like, like, anthropological experiment behind it as well.
Sure. But that's, you know, that's because it always amazes me that I can talk to these writers about anything, and they have a hook on it.
Yeah.
I took them. And these are guys who wrote Harold and Kumar, Time Machine.
They're great.
I took them a month and a half ago to the Gene Autry Museum, to the Wells Fargo Theater for a night of Ennio Morricone music.
Oh, wow.
With a choir, an orchestra. And, you know, I bought the tickets and I said, I'm taking you guys. Just, you know, I want you to experience a little bit of my world, because I live by that music, you know. And they knew a lot about Ennio Morricone. And when the movies that he scored came up, that most of them were remote Italian movies, he scored 400 pictures, and most of them we never heard of. They were all Italian pictures that just didn't make it here, and it was brilliant. And it was the ones we heard, other than The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly and Fistful of Dollars and all those, but, you know, he did The Mission, he did The Untouchables, he did just brilliant stuff, and they were all very well versed at that, you know. So no matter how we approach the characters, they've come from all different sides, which amazes me about writers, that the real good ones can come from all different sides of the character, his youth, his adolescence, what he was like with his parents, what he was like with his friends, what he's like with the woman he loves, the girl he loves. Is the woman he married very much like his mother, or is the woman he married very much like his first girlfriend, you know, or his sister?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they take in consideration all the elements of character development. And I've done some, you know, good series. Cagney and Lacey was very well written. 6 years on Cagney and Lacey and multitude of cast members. And the writing was pretty good, really good. And two or three other shows, but nobody's ever done this. No one's ever approached it from all these different angles in a very short period of time.
Well, people didn't really do that in the 80s. I think Cagney and Lacey was like 82 to 88 or something. It was like right smack dab in the middle. And it wasn't as common on television, like, you know, just because of the episodic nature of shows. And it's like all these shows, you knew the characters, but every episode was self-contained pretty much.
Yes.
And so just because of the simplicity, and television's changed a lot now, but It was just easier. It's like, these are the good characters, these are the bad characters. The good characters are going to catch the bad characters, and it's going to all wrap up at the end of each episode. You know, it's just like it's a low stakes dramatic arc for people. But now, you know, audiences are a little more sophisticated, and they've seen a lot of stuff, and they need a little more. And so I think they need these characters to be, you know, if it was too white hat, black hat, people would be like, I don't know if I buy it, you know. But this is a story that it's like, you buy it. It makes sense, you know. It makes sense.
Well, the anthological part of new television is what stimulates audiences, I think, where, you know, where every show is hooked into the next one. You know, and in the 80s, no, we didn't do that in the 80s. It was just act one, act two, act three, you know. And, I try to think about where that began, because if you – one of my favorite shows was The Newsroom with Jeff Daniels. Mm-hmm. I loved it. You know, I love Outlander.
Yeah.
You know, I love Outlander. And I cry when I watch Outlander. It's so romantic, and it's so what I want to do. I want to touch a rock and go back.
You transport and go back in time?
I don't even want to stay in contemporary times. I want to go back and touch a rock and go back into 1748, except I don't want to fight the English and lose.
No. You just want to like live on a nice farm somewhere.
I live on a farm if I have to be a warrior once in a while.
Yeah.
But even Vikings, I got a little turned off by Vikings because they were killing so much, and it was so glib when they did it.
Yeah.
You know, it was treated as if it was farming.
Right.
You know? And but I liked the period. I mean, the Old West, and I mean, I've gone to mediums and chatted with them, and I was definitely in ancient Rome, and I was, according to the mediums, I was a soldier. And what did they call me? I was a soldier. Because my name, Martin, means warlike in Latin.
Okay.
And so I think...
Oh, from Mars.
Yeah, from Mars, or Martin means warlike, and I guess maybe the derivative of M-A-R. Maybe so, I don't remember. But in Latin, it means warlike, and I don't like war. I'm really a pacifist, you know. I mean, I'm really a character from the Old West that wishes I was still back there, you know. But there's so many places, you know, that I'd love to go back. I was born on the day the Alamo fell, so I was definitely metaphysically, you know. I start a movie in Dallas tomorrow. I go to tomorrow with Stephen Lang and William Sadler and Fred Williams.
Oh, he's great. Yeah, oh, man.
It's called VFW, and... It's all about it's the Expendables in a bar, in a Veterans of Foreign Wars bar that we all frequent, and we were all together in Vietnam, and now we are in a siege fighting bad guys, and it's really interesting because, you know, it kind of a lot of this character is John Kreese. It's him reverting back to war times, which John Kreese often does when things don't work out and Cobra Kai is not respected. Mm-hmm. The concept, the integrity of Cobra Kai not respected, it's like someone coming in and not respecting your child.
Right.
You know, some cleaning person came in and pushed your kid aside because he couldn't clean the carpet. You know, he'd go crazy. So that's what it's like. You know, in this character, you know, he's rich, like John Kreese, and he's a lot like John Kreese, but John Kreese is flawed, but so is everybody else in the show, which makes it so attractive.
Right.
And we all follow, and they write where you binge. You really need to know what happens the next episode.
Right.
So if you're lucky enough to do it and see all 10 in one night, you'll do it. Otherwise, you'll break it into two parts. But my son Jesse, who, you know, is just my sort of like my co-manager. He's brilliant. He's an actor. He's 28. We did a bunch of movies together, and he watched season one and just redid my entrance like 5-6 times because he got such a kick out of it because he's a big kid. I kind of looked back and I kept thinking, well, what am I going to do next? What am I going to do in season two? I really look good in season one. What the hell am I going to do? They better write me some good stuff. And they did. They really did. And the show is terrific. I mean, we watched all 10 episodes, and it's wonderful.
I love how passionate you are about the Old West. And you said your house sort of is very Western What is it about the Old West that is attractive to you? Is it the simplicity? Is it the white hat, black hat? Is it the sort of the pioneering or the establishing of a society? What is it?
You hit it. It's like the establishing of a society, of how difficult it was. That's when Americans were so extremely strong. And even John Kreese feels this way.
Yeah.
That's what they pushed west because of religious persecution or whatever, whether they were immigrants or whether they were just Americans who were adventurous. But you fought the weather. I mean, just imagine the Oregon Trail. Imagine, coming across the center of the country where Lewis and Clark had mapped. I mean, it was 1840, 1850, 1860, even before the railroad, and there were people who didn't want to work, who were bad guys, who could raid your house at any time. There was never sheriffs or marshals, really, within 100 miles, unless you had a little farm very close to a town. And it was just a time of bravery and courage and not knowing the elements and just dealing with it one step at a time for a new life. And I often think about that because L.A. has gotten tough. It's tough to live here, the traffic and this and that. Yet I would miss my family if I left. And I have a year and a half old grandson that I adore. So, and my kids are 28. So I kind of would love to leave and have my ranch and a couple of horses. Except, it's hard because business is here and you want to cultivate, a lot of interesting things. But when I work in Atlanta for 3 months, it's wonderful. If I ever get the time, I'd go out, get a horse, and just go out to the outskirts and just ride. I just watched the Highwaymen with.
Oh yeah, yeah, I saw the trailer for that.
Good stuff, and they shot in Atlanta. And I was asked to do one of the parts in that. It was just a small part, and I wanted to do it because it was with Kevin, but I didn't. And because he and I did Wyatt Earp, and he's just a terrific filmmaker.
Right.
But, in short, it's just, I think that coming out west and the fact that the Western itself was the first American cinematic heritage, it's our heritage on film. Because back in the days of 1906, when they did the first silent Western, which was called The Great Train Robbery, all the people who were at Gunfight OK Corral, all the people who lived in Tombstone and lived in Dodge City and lived in really tough towns like Deadwood and all, they were still around in 1906. So when they were making these movies about these outlaws and about the situations in these Western towns, that all happened in 1870, 1880, 1890. So it came around 1906. A lot of those people were still around, whether they lived in Chicago or they lived in Kansas City or wherever there was a movie theater. They would come and hear about this thing called the silent movie. And most of the films were Westerns.
Mm-hmm.
From 1920 to 1967, one of every three pictures coming out of this town was a Western. And that's why it's such an overexposed genre now. It's hard to get them going because everybody, like you said earlier, everybody has such sophisticated tastes. You got to really entertain them to have them gravitate to your project.
Right. Yeah. But it's, it's funny that we watch people watch a show like Survivor or Naked and Afraid. Like, oh my gosh, those people, boy, they lived in the elements for like 2 weeks, And it was just a period of time where literally death was around every corner. The elements, the animals, whatever it was, other humans. Like it was, I get anxious even thinking about it because most people now would not be prepared for that kind of lifestyle. We've gone, if Kreese is, the way that you describe him, then he would absolutely think, we've all gone soft. What is this?
Kreese packs when he goes to the bathroom.
He's ready for a fight.
He's ready for a fight in the bathroom. And he lives there, so it's really, yeah, it's how you look at it. I mean, but that's really, you're 100% right. When we go camping now, and it's a good example, you go camping in the wilds you know, and I like camping. Every year we go to the Hole in the Wall, where Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid used to hide out. And it's a group that I go with about 30, 40 members, Hole in the Wall gang, and we ride for 4 days in chaps and dusters, full vintage, cowboy vintage. And we are going in places that they're hairy. I mean, there were places, you know, it's Casey, Wyoming. It's out there. And, you know, you fly to Casper, Wyoming, you drive 90 minutes to Casey, Wyoming, and then you drive in a truck 90 minutes into the prairie, you know. Whether it's that or you're camping in Big Sur, there's a lot of unsurety there that, you know, the public now, they don't indulge in enough. You know, probably, you know, if you go to Oklahoma City to the Cowboy Hall of Fame events and all that, everybody knows it, you know. But in the big cities, I think people shy away from that. And here in L.A., a lot of people like to go to Cabo. They'll go ahead to go to where it's simple and elegant.
Well, our weakness is that we, you know, we will always gravitate toward comfort. It, physically, emotionally, you know, and I think that's... obviously, Crease is the far end of the spectrum, but it feels like we should be more comfortable with some discomfort, you know, because that does make us stronger. And seeking comfort, always, 100% of the time, seeking comfort is not going to prepare you for anything. And that's how, you know, that's how you can get taken advantage of or lose stuff or not be prepared or, you know. And so it's – there is some of it that – like a little degree of it, but just in moderation, you know. And so we're just – it's just trying to figure out like what – to what degree should we, you know, seek some discomfort once in a while.
When you go horseback riding and you're up there alone, and I took a friend of mine who's in the Garmin Center years ago. I took him riding up in Colorado with one man as our guide. And Chuck was our guide, and he came with a very green pack horse. And the pack horse was very green, and somehow he fell off the ledge. We're up a place called Yampa, and we're up like, you know, 12,000 feet riding on ledges to camp, to go to this campsite. And there's only three of us, and my friend was apprehensive about a lot of stuff, very nervous fellow. And my friend David, and Chuck, pack horse, went sideways down the ledges to a ledge and, of course, pulled his horse and him down this ledge 20 feet. So thank God no one got hurt or anything. But my friend looked at this, and he just was so nervous, and he didn't know what to do. And I was off. You know, I had dropped something, and I wasn't there to watch. And I had gone back about a quarter of a mile to pick up something, my binoculars, whatever. But the bottom line was, I got there, and my friend, he couldn't enjoy the rest of the ride because the comfort zone of the guide falling down. If the guide falls down, what's going to happen to me? And he was really nervous. And I took a Valium. And I said, David, open your mouth. I threw a 5-gram Valium into his mouth, right? And he was good. And every like 6 hours, he would get a little antsy. And I'd say, David, open up. I go, boom. And I threw a 5-gram Valium in his mouth. And he was good for the whole trip. And it became a monumental trip. And we went up 12,000 feet to this area. It was all the, you know, there were the tops of trees. It was great, the timberline. And he never forgot that. But it was all about not being comfortable. And yet the beauty of being on top of the mountain and seeing what it's like up there. And it's like you say, when it's tough, you learn a lot more as an actor. When it's tough and you can't master a character, you will struggle and struggle and struggle. But by the time you get to that point that you said there's beauty at the end, it correlates with being on at campsite and seeing what the hell we just went through with the guide and all I experienced and then getting to timber, and it was all worth it.
Yeah.
And as an actor, you get a part that's really rough and you can't put it together and you spend a lot of time with your coach. When you shoot it and you just let it all go, and then people come up to you and say, that was fantastic. And then when you like it, I rarely like anything I do, but when you like it, then you know you've done something right, and that's the luxury of acting. Yeah.
And you've done some great, I mean, you did a Rockford Files, didn't you? You've done some legendary legendary television. I would imagine you probably did all the rounds. You probably did a Rockford Files, maybe a Streets of San Francisco. Right. You probably like,
did you do this? Did you read this?
I knew about Rockford Files, and I'm just guessing on the other ones because
you're right. What else? What else? Where are each other ones?
Oh my God!
See how good you
are. You must have done there. Did you ever do like SWAT or like Emergency 911, like any of those like medical shows or rescue shows?
Well, I did the rescue show. It was called Code R. It was a lifeguard, fireman, or policeman. We lasted one season, and it was during that period of time. It's 1976. But the show I did afterwards leads in. I did a Charlie's Angels. And I kidnapped Sammy Davis Jr.
Oh, my God. Yeah. And he played himself in the show.
He played himself, yeah.
Yeah.
And he's a great fast draw artist. I mean, the cat could draw fast. And we're talking Westerns like you and I are. And we're in his motorhome, and he pulls out this double rig, gorgeous double rig. And it's carved by Arvo Ojala and had his initials on it. And, of course, you know, it fit his waist. And we're fast drawing. He's putting me to sleep with this. You know, he's boom, boom, boom. And he's so fast. He was the fastest in Hollywood. No one knew this because he didn't do very many Westerns. And he gave it to me. Gives me this double black leather rig. I couldn't wear it around my waist because my waist was too big. But I had it for years. And Quentin calls me to come and play and do his movie. And I was ecstatic. And I said, this thing's been sitting on my saddle since 1977. Who would love this more than anybody else, of anybody I know? So the week I'm working with Quentin, I bring it, and I say, if I'm going to have a good day, I'll give it to him. If I feel really good, I'll give it to him, you know?
You were auditioning him.
I was. And he was so terrific. He was so much fun. And, you know, he's such a, you know, we kind of did this scene where I put I'm sitting on a chair, leaning back like this, like Henry Fonda did in My Darling Clementine. This very classy scene where Henry Fonda is playing Wyatt Earp. And it's a very classic scene, and he puts his feet up on a post and does this little thing. He's waiting for someone. And, you know, I knew the scene. And he says, you know the scene? I said, yeah, what do you think? You're the only one who knows it. My Darling Clementine. It's a John Ford classic, you know. And he was great. He was great the whole day. And at the end of the day, I've told this story before. At the end of the day, he says, you know, I got everything I want, because my stuff was all about the Caprio and Western sequence. And he says, I think I got everything I want, Marty, but I want one more. And he turns around to all his 100 crew members and says, and why? And all of them say in unison, because we love to make movies.
Oh, that's so sweet.
It brought tears to my eyes. And then I decided I got to give him my holster. So I went back to my trailer, came back, gave it to him. He was ecstatic. He's just terrific. He's the guy to work for. That's why people work for him for no lines. People will work for him to do dual roles, you know, because he loves making movies and he loves working with actors.
But I also like the idea that that you saw this thing that had been given to you, and a lot of people would have taken that to their grave, maybe even been buried in it. But that you were, because, you know, you see, we collect a lot of stuff here too, like a lot of memorabilia stuff and things that are important to us. But just sort of knowing, like, well, I'm like the temporary custodian of this thing, and at a certain point, I need to pass it to someone else, who hopefully will then pass it to someone else. You know, much in the same way that we, you know, that stories were told, mm-hmm. you know, so you've passed this experience to him, and hopefully, you know, someday it'll go to someone else and then they will take care of it temporarily. But I didn't know that about Sammy Davis Jr.
Yeah, he was great. You are a romantic, Chris.
I am.
You are. I mean, not just what's in your house, but just to think that way, because that is how things should get passed down.
Yes.
Not thrown in some auction somewhere. And, you know, even if it's in an auction, I guess that constitutes that it's passing down to someone. But when you know who it's passing down to, that they'll appreciate, you know, whatever, you know, it's very exciting. There are certain things I keep. I kept my big cutout that was in my dojo.
Oh, that's awesome.
You know, I have that. And I have a lot of things I gave to charity, a lot of the Rambo stuff I gave to charity, the vests and everything. But there are key things you keep to pass down, you know, and the key pictures and things like this to pass down to your kids when you pass, you know. And there's certain things that really move you early on in your career that you just like your first press kit, you know.
Yeah.
From your first series.
Well, yeah, because it's all I mean, the idea of ownership is an illusion. We're not here forever, you know. So it's like we just sort of we're curators for a while, and then it's, you know, hopefully some of these things survive and get passed down and they're meaningful to other people. What was your first press kit?
First press kit was Hard Time on Planet Earth.
Oh, it was.
That was the first press kit, and it was really good. I mean, it was the series that I starred in without the girls, and I don't remember a Code R press kit. And then I did another series right after Code R called We've Got Each Other, which was a sitcom. I don't think there was a press kit there because I joined the series after the first episode. But I still have the Karate Kid press kit. I still have a press kit of Steel Justice, my first romantic action picture that I starred in, you know. And I try to collect them, you know. Things you're proud of,
mm-hmm.
you know. It's a lot of stuff that, you know, I'm past the stage of taking on a movie where I was arrogant enough to say, the script is okay, but my performance, you know, it's a good character. I really like the character. I could fix the script with my portrayal. Those days of the arrogant level of thinking that have passed. Because if it's not on the page, no matter what you do, it's not going to enhance it any.
Right.
So I just, you know, try to wait to get to work with guys like, you know, like John, Josh, and Hayden, because it's just really lucky. It's the gift that keeps – these guys are the gifts that keep giving, and I just think we're real lucky.
What do you think – even – I'm just kind of thinking about what you said about Ennio Morricone – and also just the idea that, you know, gosh, 80% of the things that we do, that we try to do, don't even make it to people's eyes. And then of the 20% that do, you know, a percentage of those, it's like a lot of people don't see, or it doesn't work out or whatever. And so you've had a career in this business for so long. How do you define success? You know, is it material? Is it experiential? Is it a personal thing? Is it, you know, obviously it's not incredibly healthy to think it's based on what other people think, but we do fall into that trap sometimes. So what is it? You know, even just hearing about Ennio Morricone, it's like, yeah, he's done like 400 things. And most people will never know about the majority of those things. So what is it? Like, what do you think defines success in this business?
You know, it's a question that comes up all the time because kids come up to you and say, what is it? You know, what advice do you have for me? And tell me, what do you think your break was? I don't think I've had a break. I don't think of it. You know, they talk about you being an icon. People use that word all the time. I don't think of myself as an icon. Sean Connery is an icon. You know, Anthony Hopkins is an icon. Jack Nicholson is an icon. You know, I mean, Bobby De Niro is an icon. So you just John Wayne, all those people. I don't think of myself as being there, but. I get asked, what do you think your break was? I don't think I've had a break. The break is realizing that the work requires, at any age, that the work requires complete devotion to finding out what about three stages, what you were like as a kid in your background, what would you like growing up, and what's happening to you now, you know? And to really delve into the character and create backstory for me works enormously. And that, to me, when I think I've done all those things, then I think the character is going to be successful. I haven't had a chance this week to work out all those things on that character in VFW. And, you know, he's a car salesman, and he's the only guy of all the guys that's got something going in his life. Everybody else is kind of alcoholic and hangs out at the VFW and I haven't done that work yet for myself. I've been doing press
sure,
like crazy.
Yeah, of course.
So I haven't had a minute. And I'm getting insecure about it because we start shooting Monday. So I got to really work on it over the next few days. And I leave tomorrow and we're going to have 4 days of rehearsal. And I'll work it out. But the thing is that's what's important to me. That constitutes success. If I've done that for the character, I used to beat myself up if the movie didn't do well. And I said, what could I have done? It was better. Why couldn't I make it better? You can't. There's so many elements that go into a successful project: distribution, promotion, a good director, great chemistry with all the actors, a good script. You know, you're going to have, and it's got to be the right time of year to let it go.
Right.
There are so many elements that constitute a success. And what constitutes a successful career? I think good representation, doing good projects, not falling into the thing I fell into of thinking I could fix stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I think the key for me is what you said before. We do get caught up in external gratification and what people think of you and what they write of you and all that. Some of it's true, some of it isn't. And I think it's really hard. I think you have to stay away from the printed matter because, I mean, right now we've had nothing but great printed matter. You know, we had 24 reviews were great. We had 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. We're the most successful show in 2018 via Rotten Tomatoes. And, but yet you can't just read that. You just got to do the work. You got to still worry about John Kreese. You got to still worry about what's he going to deal with in season, you know, when they announce a season 3, what's going to happen to him? And you got to spend time with it. That constitutes success for me. You know, when a character is exciting to watch on screen, you know, and I've done X, Y, and Z. Some of them were. Some of them, the guy laid there like a lox. He just did. You know, I mean, I was either confused or it wasn't written well, and I had the thing about, you know, analyzing my character and feeling I could do a better job without doing the backstory. Wrong. You just have to do the work. And if you do the work, that's what I always enforce on my son. You do the work. We saw some footage that he did, a movie called Blood and Sand. It's a terrific story. A platoon just before D-Day takes out these howitzers that would have destroyed all the battleships on Omaha Beach. And this is a real story. It happened 2 days before June 6th, D-Day. And Jesse stars in it with Weston Cage, Nick's son.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw the footage yesterday. It was brilliant. And it's a little movie out of Asylum. And it's a terrific little picture. And what he did was brilliant. Because it was a character under stress of war. It's something like he's never done before. A character under stress of war, war paint, not wanting to be there, the level of expediency, the level of jeopardy that he was under in World War II that our boys were under. And it was wonderful. Best work I've ever seen him do. And it was all because of all these elements that you have to just osmose into when you're doing a period piece, which I think period pieces are the best. I'm not into contemporary. John Kreese is not a contemporary character. John Kreese is a throwback into, you know, if Wyatt Earp got sick, he'd take his place,
right.
You know? So that's the deal, you know, and that's what I love. That's why I love Westerns and love, you know, going back in time and playing anything of the past, because somehow all the elements of the past add to me, to my better interpretation as an actor of the character. It just does.
And you also just never know, you know, there's just something about staying on the train long enough in the business. It's like, of the million things that you've done, you know, I'm sure having people this many years later shout, sweep the leg at you, you know, like was there ever a point where you're like, yeah, I get it. I remember, but I've done other stuff, you know, like what's the, because you seem so cool with it and you're so cool with the fans and so happy that this thing has survived for so long. Did you always have that appreciation for it?
Well, I did. I think it did. I thought it was a classic movie. We went to the emergency room last night and my little grandson had a stomach problem and he's real little. So we took him to the emergency room, and an old man, African-American old man, came up to me waiting in the emergency room. And he says, in his real gruff voice, he says, and this was 11 o'clock at night because I just zoomed over there when I heard that he was not well. And he says, you're in the movies, aren't you? He says, I didn't want to come over and talk to you, but I didn't want to bother you. But I know you're in the movies. You were in the movies, weren't you? And I said, And I was wearing a Cobra Kai tank. I was wearing a Cobra Kai tank top, and I also was wearing, I had come right from my workout. So I had Cobra Kai running down my leg on my pants that I was wearing too. And I said, I smiled at him and I said, I still am. And he I don't think he got it, but it didn't matter because I didn't want to make him uncomfortable.
Sure.
And he just smiled and he says, I knew you were. And he just moved up back and just hung by the wall. He was waiting for emergency. It was the emergency room. And it just, you know, it just showed you that it's all, I love that movie. It's great. Have I done other things? Yeah. Does everybody really remember Sweep the Leg, Mercies for the Week? They remember it more because it's an iconic movie like Casablanca, my favorite film of all time.
Yeah.
People remember Play It Again, Sam. They remember. We made a movie about called Play It Again, Sam. You know, rather, it was a movie that became pretty popular that Woody Allen did. So anyway, the point being is that you just live with it because I still live in fantasy. I still have my, you know, stuff on the walls, and you try to do Westerns. If you get it, you get it. But I, you know, you think you've done other things, but it's what's good that you really remember. There's a lot of stuff that you've done that you don't think about. Some of those episodic shows, you know, it's a different world making an episodic show in those days. You know, the use of the zoom lens, and, you know, no one would dare do that today, you know, because audiences are so much more sophisticated. So if you please the audiences today, I think you've accomplished something. You know, if it's run from 1984 all the way to now, and they're still talking about it, like Casablanca, like The Searchers, like Red River, like The Wild Bunch, all these classics, like Star Wars. I mean, how many movies, you can actually conceive the movies we remember lines from. If you went going as far back as Casablanca, we'll Play It Again, Sam, or The Searchers, all right, Pilgrim, you know, or The Force Be With You, or Sweep the Leg, and Mercy is for the Weak. I mean, if you really just go back, there's only maybe 10 movies we really remember in the last 50 or 60 years that you say these lines from. And those movies, I believe, if you're part of any of those, it just allows you to survive in this insane business.
And also, you make people happy. Like, you connect with people. This guy who came up to you in the emergency room, that allowed you to connect with someone that you maybe, you're like just someone randomly in public that you wouldn't have thought you would have had a moment with. And ultimately, that's, you know, that's part of the human experience. And you're the catalyst for that. You know, you're a catalyst for that. And this has been such a pleasure talking to you. I really appreciate that you came in.
Thank you.
And congratulations on VFW, which you're about to go shoot. And then Cobra Kai Season 2 is on YouTube Red now. I'm posting this when it's
April 24th, I think.
Yeah, this will go up that day. So it's available. As soon as this podcast is done, you can go watch all of Season 2 of Cobra Kai. And I'm really excited to see. I'm excited to unpack John Kreese. But I'm also, now that I've had a chance to sit and talk with you, I'm so excited to see all the other things that you do from here. Because it seems like, you know, you'll work as long as you feel like working until the range fully calls you.
As you know, I thought about that a lot. And, you know, it's interesting. But I mean, from your mouth to God's ears, you know, work as long as you want. But the range, you know, it's a controversy. I really would like to go out there. I mean, what Kevin does is great. Kevin Costner has a place in Aspen and a place in Carpinteria. And, you know, he lives that cowboy world. He makes all his movies. That's why I loved working with him and befriending him, because I haven't seen him in a while. But everything he makes, whether it's Waterworld or The Postman or The Highwayman, or the series he's got on TV, it's all the West.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's interpreting it, it's all the West. It's what those heroes went through in the lifetime of America. And I believe that those heroes should be celebrated. The Texas Rangers, all those characters. And they all had ups and downs politically, every one of them. But, I mean, I think, you know, there's a reason why I was born on the day the Alamo fell, because, and there's a reason why we're shooting in Dallas, leaving tomorrow, because I'm supposed to be there for a while.
Yeah.
You know, Texas is, I find that Texas is so solid, and it's patriot time, and it's great. You know?
Well, great. Well, thank you so much for being here, Marty. It's really been a pleasure to talk to you.
Great. Same here, man.
Thanks, man. The end.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
You have just ingested via your ears Martin Cove, episode 997 on the ID10T podcast. It's now time for some word salad wrap for this episode. I saw something that I really liked on the Stoicism subreddit, which I am on a lot. I'm a lurker. I've never posted anything on there. But there was a post by user Astral Fatality, and the post title was "On Letting Go of Regret and Growing from One's Past Mistakes." I came up with this thought process, and I thought I should share it. So, I'll read what it is, and then I'll sort of explain it. He says, or she says, "I no longer feel regret, for there was only one choice that I could have made and was variably unfit for any other choice at the given time, as no other choice was made other than the choice that was made, and any other choice that would have been made would not be the I who made the choice that I did make." Now, I think this is really kind of an important way to free yourself from the shitstorm of "I should have done this, I should have said that, why didn't I do this, why didn't I make this choice?" So a couple months ago, I got to do an episode of Whose Line Is It Anyway, which was such a huge deal to me. I can't even really put words to properly express brain thinkings. It was an incredible, absolutely incredible experience that I certainly never thought I would get to do. Wayne Brady had been on the podcast a while ago, and I haven't posted it yet because I was waiting until I got some idea of what the air date was going to be so that I could sort of bundle it all together. But Wayne was amazing on the podcast. And so we did some improvs. It was, it was Wayne, Proops, Ryan, Colin Mockery. And there was one scene that I did, and I feel like I did okay, you know? I feel like I kind of held my own a bit. But then afterwards, of course, "Oh, I should have said this, I should have said that, I should have said this, I should have said that." And I was talking to Wayne about it afterwards, and I said, "You know, that one was really fun, but there are like 10 other things I wish I had said." And he was like, "Well, welcome to the curse of the improviser." You're always going to sort of beat yourself up about what you should have said, but you know. But it's always, but again, the hindsight is 20/20 thing is very true. It's always easy once you have all the information, you know, what you do in the moment. Who you are in a moment is who you are, and that's who you were ready to be in that moment. And so to be able to take a step back and say, you know what, those are the choices that I made in that moment, that's what came out, and that's how it was supposed to be, does give me peace in sort of letting it go. Because you can fucking, you can put the thumb screws on your brain for the rest of your life if you want to replay stuff over and over and over and over and over again. You know, now obviously, like, you know, if you rob a convenience store, maybe that's a choice you should feel bad about. 100% that's a choice you should feel bad about. But I just mean, like, in our day-to-day lives, how we invent narratives just to punish ourselves, just because, you know, fuck us, we think. I deserve to punish myself all the time. Why not? Don't think that way. You don't deserve it, and you shouldn't. And this hopefully is one way to kind of free yourself of just letting go and say, you know, whatever I chose in that moment was what it was for that moment. And you also think about it this way. You know, sometimes I'll see people watch, this is all going to come back around. I'll see people complain about an episode of, you know, a series, any series. And they'll go, "Oh, this episode, this episode didn't have to be this way, or they didn't have to do X, Y, or Z." And I always think to myself, Well, you don't know that because you haven't seen the whole series yet. So you don't know if and when that thing that you thought was useless is going to pay off. And so that's what I would say about our own lives is you don't know how the story ends. So whatever choice you made in a certain moment or whatever thing came out, you don't know if that's going to lead you to something better. Even if you think it's bad, you know, you're clouded by insecurities and baggage and trauma and all sorts of things and bad addictive self-flagellation habits. So you might just be programmed to give yourself shit no matter what, which is kind of nice to think of too, because that sort of frees you of like, oh, that's just a thing I do. Maybe it's not real. But all the thoughts that you have are not necessarily real in the sense that that doesn't mean that they're true. Just because you have a thought doesn't mean that it's necessarily true. So even if you imagine some sort of a social situation going better, oh, I could have said this and everyone would have laughed and I would have been carried off on everyone's shoulders and everything would have been great. You still don't know that and you still don't know where that would have led. So I would just say for today, go easy on yourself. Don't feel regret. There was one choice that you could have made it was variably unfit for any other choice at the given time. So just free yourself from that. If you can just free yourself from little bits here and there from torturing yourself, then it will net out very favorably. And think of all the inventing space you'll create in your brain to think of new ideas that aren't giving yourself a hard time. So again, take it easy on yourself. Go easy on yourself. You're worth it. I appreciate you. Thank you for listening to Word Salad Rep for episode 997. I'll see you in your ears next week.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.
Hey, listeners, it's Will Arnett. Our podcast, Smartless, has crossed a milestone that seemed unfathomable when we started nearly 4 years ago, as we've just released our 200th episode. Join us as we welcome that dynamic duo of hilarity, Steve Martin and Martin Short. You've seen them on screen together in The Three Amigos, Father of the Bride 1 and 2, and most recently, and only Murders in the Building. Both are comedic geniuses in their own right, but together they are always electric, and this episode of Smartless is no exception. I don't know if I've laughed more in a single episode than this one. We discuss their career arcs both separately and as a comedy team, how they met, who is more difficult to work with, and what motivates them today. Is Steve a better banjo player than Marty as a singer? Find out on this bicentennial episode of Smartless. Follow Smartless in the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Smartless ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Plus, you get to hear Sean cry. What a loser!